up is the news.
The Russian president orders the military to act as peacekeepers in two regions in eastern Ukraine hours after he recognized them as independent republics. The U.S. imposes sanctions against the territories recognized by Russia in eastern Ukraine as the EU says it will react with unity and firmness in solidarity with Kiev. Also in the headlines, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says reaching an agreement for reviving the 2015 deal requires the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and securing the interests of the Iranian nation. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, big news on the Ukraine crisis. Russia recognizes the independence of the two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine. In a televised meeting, Vladimir Putin signed a decree recognizing the independence of Donetsk and Lugansk, along with cooperation agreements. In a speech, Putin accused Ukrainian forces of killing civilians in the regions and demanded that Kiev immediately end military operations there or face responsibility for possible bloodshed. Putin has ordered his defense ministry to send peacekeepers to the breakaway regions. Russia has repeatedly denied any plan to attack Ukraine or annex Donetsk and Lugansk. In his speech, Putin accused the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop the eastward expansion of NATO.
Today, we can only take a look at the map to understand how Western countries hold their promise to prevent NATO expansion to the east. They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin said he has information that the question of Ukraine joining NATO is already decided, and it is just a matter of time. Putin said Kiev's admission to the Western military alliance would pose a major security threat to his country, as this will multiply the danger of a sudden strike against Russia. Putin said the US and NATO have fully ignored Russia's security concerns and its requests for equal dialogue. He said Russia has now every right to take measures to protect its security, sovereignty, and values. The Russian president played down repeated threats of sweeping anti-Russia sanctions over Ukraine. He said the West would impose sanctions against Moscow regardless of the situation in Ukraine as they aim to stop Russia's development. While Russia's recognition of the two breakaway self-declared Donbass republics has sparked a tide of reactions worldwide, with unsurprisingly critical remarks coming from the West, the U.S. has announced sanctions against the Lugansk and Donetsk territories in eastern Ukraine. It also pledged additional measures over the, quote, blatant violation of Russia's international commitments. European Union leaders Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel denounced the move as a flagrant breach of international law, the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and the Minsk agreements. They warned that the bloc and its allies will react firmly. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the recognition as an ill omen and a dark sign that things are moving in the wrong direction.
This is plainly in breach of international law. It's a violation, a flagrant violation of the sovereignty and integrity of Ukraine.
Separately, the UK Foreign Secretary said that sanctions against Russia will be announced on Tuesday. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg also condemned Russia's decision, accusing Moscow of seeking to stage a pretext to invade Ukraine once again. NATO members Poland and Latvia slammed what they described as the act of aggression against Ukraine and called for immediate sanctions. French President Emmanuel Macron called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council and the adoption of targeted European sanctions. Germany says Russia is breaking all its promises to the international community and has dealt a heavy blow to all diplomatic efforts to find a diplomatic solution to the standoff over Ukraine. Meanwhile, the UN chief has scrapped his visit to Africa, citing the, quote, worsening situation regarding Ukraine. Joining us for more on this story, developing story, is Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer from San Francisco, and also Daniel Patrick Welch, a geopolitical analyst from Boston. Scott, welcome. You know, Russia said all along it won't invade Ukraine, and even during those back and forth responses between Moscow and Washington over Russia's security guarantees, the Kremlin declared it has no intention of attacking Ukraine, but it didn't get the security guarantees. Do you think is that what has led to the development today of Moscow recognizing the eastern part, those eastern regions of Ukraine as independent territory?
Well, I think this has been a long time coming, and it's because of the crimes against humanity that have been inflicted on the poor people of the People's Republic of Donetsk and the People's Republic of Lugansk that has caused them to be officially recognized by the State Duma of Russia. And President Putin simply recognized and affirmed the decision of the entire Russian continent and people when they expressed they were going to defend the lives and the language and the culture of the Russian people that have been subjected to nothing less than genocide and war crimes and artillery shelling of civilians, old men and little children being killed mercilessly with a Roman Catholic fanaticism against the Russian Orthodox people and language and church in that area. So that has been the root of this fanaticism and genocide against the people in that area. And I applaud this decision of President Putin and the State Duma to serve as a shield to defend women and children and old people in Donetsk and Lugansk that have no political agenda other than to speak Russian and enjoy and practice their culture. This has been a terrible genocide. And as like Vladimir Putin and many others have commented, Ukraine is not an independent country. It is a puppet run by an imbecile, also known as a comedian, after the CIA overthrew the first president that promised a closer neutrality with the European Union and a moral affinity with Russia, because President Yanukovych did not subscribe to the anti-family agenda of the West.
Right, Scott, instead, bear with me. Right, Scott, bear with me. Let me bring in Daniel. Daniel, do you agree with what Scott noted there, the suffering of the people in Donetsk and Lugansk and Russia's involvement here?
Yes. I mean, I think in that stretch, Scott is exactly right. I think that the things that led up to today are long standing, and by Putin's own admission, it's something that the Russians should have done a long time ago. They were central to Minsk, and a lot of detractors on the side of the people of Donbas took them to task in 2014, 2015, because they didn't, you know, roll in a cavalcade of tanks and seize the eastern half of the country. They said, look, let's try to work this out. And Minsk, these people have discovered Minsk since 3 o'clock this afternoon, our time. That's the whole point, is that Kiev had zero intention of fulfilling its obligations under Minsk, which was to work with the two republics to achieve some degree of autonomy and self-rule. They never intended to do it, and they went with that on the one hand, and the attacks. They attacked. They started attacking 4 or 5 days ago as the West was covering it up with their own hype. And they have these massive shelling of civilian areas. That plus Schultz's comment about how it's absurd to picture these the ethnic cleansing of the Donbass in terms of genocide was incredibly offensive to the Russian people at large. And I think it struck them that you're not going to trust a German politician to safeguard Russians when the destruction of Slavs is the overt mission of the neo-Nazis, who are part and parcel of the coup that took over Ukraine 8 years ago.
You know, Scott, there's one comment that I think we should, just discuss, just touch up on, that the biggest winner is the U.S., as it can now push Europe further away from Russia. Would you agree?
No, I don't think the U.S. benefits from this in any way. I think this benefits the people of Lugansk and Donetsk. That's why you see them celebrating with fireworks and blowing car horns, because they're joyous, because their lives and their language and their culture is going to be preserved. Don't be surprised that the United States under Biden and Canada under Trudeau are becoming totalitarian police states. They have in fact set up sanctions against their own citizens, similar to what Ukraine did to its own citizens. So what has caused the dismemberment and the breakup of Ukraine is the same thing that most likely is going to break up Canada into separate republics, and is now also happening in the United States with Florida and Texas and other states actively seeking separation from the Biden administration. So the U.S. and Europe, really, in a sense, the free peoples of Europe benefit, because they see that the future is not a unipolar world. The future is a unipolar world with smaller independent republics that are not tied to the slavery of the United States or the United Kingdom. And I would hope this would ripple so that Scotland separates itself from England, and Wales separates itself from England, and Ireland separates itself, and other regions of Europe recognize that the next renaissance of Europe lies in following the pattern that Donetsk and Lugansk has set, and their prosperity, right, and their happiness will also be followed with no kinetic war operations. And you will see, you know, a drastic selling point is Russia is entering into a peace agreement with these nations.
Right.
And I think it balances out NATO's hostility.
Let me just get Daniel's perspective on that. Daniel, do you think the U.S. provoked this crisis to try and damage Russian relations with Europe, especially when you consider the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with Germany,
absolutely,
for example?
Yeah, Nord Stream 2 is the main goal of this whole thing. The trouble is that because of that it would accrue to the benefit of the U.S. because there is a temporary pressure on Germany to stop Nord Stream 2. But Nord Stream 2 is a fact. This is a temporary glitch, and the U.S. has proven to its European vassal states that it's the crazy brother-in-law at Thanksgiving, and you got to kind of keep him, you know, under control, but get him out of the house as quickly as you can. That is what's going to happen to the European Union. They're realizing that the U.S. is really against their interest. Germany has known this and has tried to push ahead with the gas, getting gas for its citizens at half the price of the U.S.'s LNG tankers, you know, coming in across the Atlantic. I mean, what a ridiculous,
right,
idea, you know, to buy, you know, your chickens from some guy in New Zealand when your neighbor is raising them in his backyard farm.
Sure.
It's it is not going to go well for the U.S., I think, specifically because that is a temporary obstacle. I think that the gravity and the physics of it militates so strongly toward the Eurasian integration and toward the Belt and Road project that China has started, and toward a more multipolar world order that is finally going to wrest itself from the yoke of U.S. Right. and British Empire domination.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Daniel, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Let me thank our guests, Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us live from San Francisco, and also Daniel Patrick Welch, a geopolitical analyst, live from Boston. Turning to other news now, Iran highlights the conditions it deems necessary for any agreement to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA.
The United States should prove its will to remove major sanctions imposed on Iran. To reach a deal, the interests of Iranian people should be secured. In particular, removing sanctions, providing credible guarantees, and closing cases of political claims are necessary.
Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks during a joint presser with the Qatari Emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, in Doha. On ties with Qatar, Raisi stressed his administration's plan to expand cooperation with the Arab nation. The Qatari Emir, for his part, highlighted his country's willingness to boost bilateral ties with Iran. Earlier, the two sides signed over a dozen agreements and memoranda of understanding. Raisi's visit to Qatar is his first trip to a Persian Gulf state since taking office in June late last year. The Iranian president is also to attend the 6th summit of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum in Doha. The United Nations raises the alarm over increasing violence and human rights violations against refugees and migrants at European borders. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says these deplorable practices by some states, quote, now risk becoming normalized and policy-based. He says what is happening at European borders is legally and morally unacceptable and must stop. According to the UN Refugee Agency, it regularly receives reports of ill treatment and pushbacks of migrants within and beyond EU borders. The agency warns that people who wish to apply for asylum should be allowed to do so and that they should be made aware of their rights and be provided legal assistance. According to UN figures, thousands of migrants die each year while trying to reach Europe in search of a better life. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials, blame the pandemic or inflation or Trumpism or stress or structural problems like inequality. But people do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Members of Congress Should Not Be Trading Stocks, Ever. And it has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. Americans are in a sour mood with their elected officials, blame the pandemic or inflation or Trumpism or stress or structural problems like inequality. But the American public do not feel that the system, much less its leaders, are working for them. The nation is experiencing a crisis of confidence that is eating away at its strength and unity. Addressing this problem calls for long-term vision and commitment, things politicians aren't always known for. But a straightforward idea gaining traction on Capitol Hill could reassure a frustrated and exhausted American public that lawmakers at least recognize this trust deficit. A ban on stock trading by members of Congress and their spouses. This idea got a fresh jolt in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic after some lawmakers first faced awkward questions about whether they used non-public information to make lucrative stock trades, just as the severity of the threat posed by the coronavirus was becoming clear. A report in December by Insider was more definitive. It revealed that in 2020 and 2021, dozens of lawmakers failed to abide by rules requiring them to promptly disclose stock trades above a certain threshold. The investigation also found that Congress does a poor job of enforcing accountability and transparency measures. In response to the uproar, there has been a push by both political parties in both houses of Congress to establish stronger guardrails on congressional stock ownership. Multiple lawmakers have introduced bills pushing variations of a ban on trading individual stocks, some tougher and more expansive than others. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy reportedly told donors in January that if, as expected, Republicans win back the House in the midterm elections this fall, they would work to pass legislation that would limit lawmakers' ability to trade stocks. In a high-stakes election year, with lawmakers eager to show voters that they feel their rage, now is the moment to drive home this popular common-sense reform. The American public has lost faith in Congress. Restoring trust in this institution requires concrete bipartisan change. It has been a decade since Congress last made a significant effort at policing itself in this area. The Stock Act of 2012, among other measures, made it illegal for lawmakers to trade based on access to non-public information. The reforms were well-intentioned but inadequate. In practice, there are too many legal shades of grey. A clearer, brighter line needs to be drawn. For all of the Democratic Party's talk about restoring public faith in government, its leaders in the House of Representatives have been, until recently, resistant to talk of a trading ban for members. "We are a free market economy," House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in December. She added, "They should be able to participate in that." The Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, has been similarly weak, suggesting that a ban is unnecessary. While Mr. Hoyer owns no stock, he has said that members ought not to be in a different situation that they would otherwise be if they weren't members of Congress. This rationale does not pass the sniff test. Members of Congress have access to a steady stream of information that regular Americans do not. They already exist in a different, more privileged situation. The common argument that a trading ban would pose a hardship for lawmakers is no more compelling. Most of the proposals under consideration do not call for members of Congress to sell all their stock holdings. They would merely prohibit lawmakers from trading stocks in individual companies. Assets could still be held in vehicles such as index funds or blind trusts. It also bears noting that only a sliver of American families, about 15%, directly hold stock in individual companies, as opposed to indirectly through mutual funds and the like. A stock trading ban would put lawmakers more in sync with the 85% of the American public who own no individual stock, rather than align them with the interests of the 15% of the American public who do. A ban on congressional trading enjoys a bipartisan appeal that is rare in this polarized age. A January opinion poll found that 63% of the American voters are at least somewhat in favor of such a move. With strong backing among Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike. With the support for reform growing, Nancy Pelosi adjusted course this month, saying she was open to a ban and announcing that the House Administration Committee would look into the situation. The committee chairwoman, Zoe Lofgren of California, has said her team is analyzing the existing bills and would put together a broad-based consensus proposal. The speaker's public shift was vital to keeping the push alive, but there is a difference between grudging acceptance and vigorous support. Proponents of reform need to keep the pressure on to ensure that this effort does not get slow-walked or bogged down in the devilish details. Nancy Pelosi, for instance, insisted that reform legislation should apply not only to Congress but also to the judiciary, including the Supreme Court. It has to be government-wide, she said. The judicial branch certainly could use some ethical shoring up. An investigation last year by the Wall Street Journal found that from 2010 to 2018, 131 federal judges unlawfully ruled in cases involving companies in which they or their family members held shares. People involved in close to 800 lawsuits have since been notified that their cases are eligible to be reopened because of these conflicts. There are proposals floating around that would address all three branches of the government. Two Democrats, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Representative Katie Porter of California, recently reintroduced the bill that would tighten reporting requirements across the board, as well as bar trading of individual stocks by members of Congress, the President and Vice President, Supreme Court justices, and other top officials with the U.S. Federal Reserve, which suffered its own trading scandals last year. But trying to extend a government-wide ban, while worthy under merits, would introduce needless and potentially counterproductive complexity right now. There are, most specifically, concerns that an attempt by Congress to impose its will on the judiciary would set off a debilitating debate over the separation of powers. That is literally a different conversation, and one that is so hard to wrap your arms around that you've tanked the movement, as Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Virginia Democrat who co-wrote one of the leading reform bills, lamented to the New York Times. Lawmakers' top priority, arguably their first duty, should be to clean up their own branch of government. They are, as elected officials, directly accountable to their voters, and many of the people to whom they owe their jobs and salaries have grave doubts about their ethical guidelines and rules of fair play. In a series of recent New York Times opinion focus groups, voters across the political spectrum described their frustrations and even anger at the political class and the system, seeing elected officials in both political parties as acting in self-interest without rules or consequences. They all just go to their barbecues and cocktail parties and laugh, said one independent voter. They just want the power. They couldn't care less about us. Some Democratic voters expressed interest in term limits, curbs on lobbyist influence on lawmakers, and new rules and money in politics. The push for a trading ban is about more than imposing rules to keep lawmakers on the straight and narrow. It is about changing the widespread perception of public service as a playground for corruption and for self-dealing. It is about restoring the American public's faith in their government. For Congress, there may be no worthier cause.
Thank you. IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Kazem Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome back there, Sheikh Qasim.
Assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Let's get to today's topic, and that is an analysis on what the Islamic houses are doing all around the world. You know, of course, when you look at the world of Islam, these houses or the Islamic seminaries is better. It is a rough translation, but would not be, you know, a good translation for that. Schools, Islamic schools or seminaries all around the world are acting differently. For example, if you look at the Egypt and Al-Azhar one, you know, its function is something. But if you look at, for example, the Islamic House of Qom and Najaf, the function might be a little bit different. The both of them are doing research on Islam and different branches of the Islamic studies, but still there are some differences between the two. The main doubt that was made about the past generation of the Fuqaha, you know, that for example, an old alim beside a house in the far, far lands of Najaf or Qom or Mashhad cannot answer, for example, so many new doubts and questions about the new world. So this Jahanbini, this worldview, is lacked, for example, in the ideas of that, for example, old scholar, old man. And who is this man? This man is in charge of, for example, of an Islamic Hausa. How could that Hausa can answer the needs, the today's need of the people of human beings?
I think...
this is not my question, but the questions
around.
Yeah,
that's okay. We understand okay. That the youth and the new generation has all these questions. Look, it's pretty clear. The ulama, the Hausa system, and the scholars are Warisul Anbiya. Mm-hmm. So when you say they're Warisul Anbiya, does that mean that they're only Warisul Anbiya for religious knowledge, religious information? Were prophets only well-versed in religious content? Or no, they were well-versed in all aspects of life. And the Anbiya were the leaders of the community. They were leaders of the society. They were leaders for the mankind in all fields, all areas, be it child upbringing, be it science, mm-hmm. be it technology, be it medicine, whatever. They were leaders in that. So mm-hmm. when we say ulama are warisul Anbiya, so mm-hmm. it doesn't mean it's only in that marifat-e-ilahi or marifat-e-dini that we are expected to be leaders. Okay. We are supposed to be Warasul Anbiya, meaning lead all the different fields that are related to human beings. Mm-hmm. Take
and
example
the Quran
of...
the says, لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ. It doesn't say لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الْفِقْهِ فَقَطْ.
Correct. And deen is a way of life. Okay. Look at, take example of Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amuli, right?
Yes.
He was a great scholar. On the other hand, he was a great mathematician, right? Yeah. So who says that you can't deal with science or mathematics or physics or theoretical physics or in other fields? So there is no restriction. It all boils down to the person's interest. That is he interested in such a field?
Okay.
Is he interested in maths? Is he interested in physics? Is he interested in science? Some people may not be interested. Mm-hmm. They're very, really happy with jurisprudence and usul and fiqh, and they feel that, look, there is a need in the society now to answer these questions. So someone has to be super expert in that field, so they spend all the time there. If you look at the Western world, you'll find they're philosophers, and they are just philosophers. They don't know anything about physics or chemistry. Mm-hmm. There are those who are chemists, those who are into astronomy, and they have no idea about philosophy. So today, the world is moving towards specialization.
Yes.
So that, keeping that in mind, you would find that some scholars are specializing into usul and fiqh.
Okay.
Some are specializing into fiqh rasane, which is media and telecommunication.
Yes.
And some are specializing into fiqh of child upbringing. Some are specializing into other specific
the banking
fields.
System fiqh.
Yeah,
that's
for
right.
banking system.
Yes,
so
yes.
Now the fuqaha, the scholars are also being focused on specialization.
Yes.
So they're moving into different fields, and there's no harm that one of the scholars get into physics.
But the standard knowledge, as you know, what is needed for being an alim, you know, what is needed for being a person who is faqih fi ad-din. I think that is, you know, the standard knowledge is needed for all.
But Sheikh Qasim, some of these sciences and new systems are imported from the Western one, which has rules in the, we can say, undivine system of thought. And now when it comes to a Muslim land, we want to give it an Islamic color or religious color. For example, the banking system, the economic system, and the other parts around. How we can solve this problem? Isn't this a kind of imbalance or a harmony between the two?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the problem that we sometimes have, you know, that we just, without any, you know, research or any, you know, scrutiny, we just take in whatever we receive from the West.
The products.
You know, ignoring, you know, the basis and foundations of those knowledge or sciences. You know, where sometimes we're talking about the natural sciences like physics and biology and things like that, that may not be that much, you know, different from the way that those sciences are done, for example, in an Islamic region or Islamic country. But when it comes to human science or humanities or human sciences, that, you know, the story is completely different. So, for example, as you said, you know, economics that we're taking from the West that is based on the Western values and not religious values or better Islamic values. So now here we have some, you know, differences between the ulama, that how should we treat those sciences? Should we just take those sciences and try a sort of trim those sciences in an Islamic way, or we have to start from the very beginning of the
from
roots,
scratch.
From a scratch of those actually those sciences, and first of all lay the Islamic foundations of those sciences, and then, you know, build up the building upon that foundation.
For sure, it's a teamwork, you know.
And now it's done in some, you know, in the Hausa, actually, in some institutes of Hausa. We have this, for example, Iqtisadi Islam, Islamic economy.
Okay.
And, you know, that's actually, they're trying to lay out the, you know, the foundations of Islamic economy from the very beginning, taking use of, making use of the, you know, the Quran and traditions
and hadith,
and, you know, build up the economy that is actually expected from an Islamic government.
Okay, that's all right. Iqtisaduna again by Shahid Assad.
That's happening in many fields, including the development of the city. You must have heard that Ayatollah Araki is working on this project, and how to build an Islamic city. The heights of the building, should it be like 50 floors, 100 floors, or what does Islam say? What should be the distance between each house? What should be the sewer system? How should be the roads laid down? And he's trying to work on that. So each scholar is trying to do their part of the work.
Recently, there was a visit from the Minister of Economics of Iran to the houses of the ulama in Qom. And one of the main issues that was tackled by the ulama was this rate of the interest, or the, we can say, at the bank loans, which is really high. I do want to say the system and the banking system is getting far, far away from Qarzul Hasana, interest-free way of thought, which if you help, your income will be multiplied, But the case is vice versa now. And on different occasions, you know, when they got a visit to the Islamic houses and the ulama and the maraja, the first suggestion is cut this out, loan without interest, loan without any fine, If the repay is late, do not put the fine on the shoulders of the people and this and that. On the contrary, we have some people who have a utopian look at the Western system of the banking. But I do want to say in the banking system of the West, this is so too. The fines are over there, the loans are over there, the repayment will be with the high rate of interest, The case is so. But from an Islamic land and from Islamic banking system, we do not expect, for example, interest rate, usury or something like that. And this makes the problem really aggravated. I think it needs a teamwork of the ulama, first of all, to sit down, discuss all the, we can say, sources and resource books in order to deduce the laws from, we can say, the books, and then make it adaptable with the society in which they are living in. And each Muslim land is different from the other one.
For example, if you are living in an African land, majority of the Muslims, or the Arab one, or the Persian one, or the Turkish one, the system might be very much different. Isn't it so? Do you agree? If you got any problem.
No, actually, the point is that if you say that, you know, they take it and then teamwork with other countries and then...
with our own ones. I mean, from the Hausa and the university, for example, the academic ones, they can co-work, isn't it?
Correct. See, the Islam has a different approach towards economics by itself. You look at some of the ahadith, it has a different approach. But currently the world is being ruled by capitalist mentality. Even those who live in communist society like Russia and China and they believe in communism, if you look at their economic system, it's still being governed by the capitalist mentality, right? Okay. So one of the challenges is that, fair enough, we can have that kind of economic system, we can have that kind of a system developed and built, but when you want to implement it, are people ready for such a system? You know, within this framework of Islamic countries, if you look at the Middle East, with all those Islamic countries here, even if you have an Islamic economic system, would people really abide by it? Or, you know, it's just going to take all the bashing. For example, one of the hadiths, I'll just mention it, you know, when we were reading through Maqasib and then we were referring to some ahadiths. One of the ahadith says that, you know, if you promise your brother, mu'min brother, that come to my shop and I'll take care of you or I'll give you a rebate, then when this person visits you, the hadith says that you should charge him the least profit, you know, literally cost to cost, right? Yes. Now, if we have this kind of economic system, would people actually abide by it? Would they follow it? Or they say, brother, I can't do that because I can't live my life that way, right?
Okay.
So, to a certain extent, yes, the foundations have to be laid. But on the other hand, the people have to be prepared for it, right? If people are not prepared and you have an amazing Islamic economic system, it's still going to fail because people are not prepared for it.
Now, Sheikh Qasim, another question. This co-work, I mean, between the experts from the Hausa and from the universities... can be seen in the Islamic Republic of Iran, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, for example, as a model, because we are still new, you know, we got, you know, about 40, 45 years after the Islamic Revolution took place, and we are still at the very beginning of the path and the road. But what they say is that when Imam Khomeini struggled for this revolution, the world was surrounded by two important blocks of thought. I mean, the capitalism and the communism. And this was the third one that comes between. So I'm bringing a new model based on the prophetic tradition and the teachings of the infallible. So do you think that still there is hope introduce new methods and new methodologies that can bring a kind of peaceful coexistence between university and Hausa based on the teachings of the late Imam Khomeini, the Rahbar, you know, and the Islamic system of Iran now?
You know, when you talk about coexistence, it sort of implies that there is a tension between these. So there is no tension here.
Exactly. And I was wondering that why are you presuming that there is a tension or conflict between Hausa and university?
There is not a tension. But it might be that there are some imbalances between the two, okay?
There might be some lack of, you know, enough cooperation. Okay. Or there have to be actually this sort of... Because it used to be before the revolution of Iran. It used to be, you know, the way was like, you know, the Hausa was sort of separated from the universities since, you know, the sort of sciences or knowledges that have been tackled in these two places or these two institutions were different. But nowadays, you know, we talk already about the ways that these two are actually intermingled and they have to work with one another in order for reaching their goal. So I believe that, actually, before the revolution, towards the end, towards the beginning of the revolution, it started by people like Ayatollah Mufattih.
Yes.
And then it continued after the revolution. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, 2 days.
Shahid Mutahari's presence at the university.
Yeah, actually, it was 2 days ago. Yes. I was invited to Tehran to give some lectures for, you know, university professors,
mm-hmm.
and I had almost four hours with these people, yes. who were coming actually from scientific backgrounds. Some okay. of them were, you know, teaching, I don't know, physics, some of them chemistry and things like that. And we have, you know, very good discussions with one another.
Okay.
And I think that it's in a good, actually, situation now, and it's getting better, inshallah.
Okay, inshallah, hand in hand, the house and university, this calls from both, in inshallah. Order to solve the problems to the Muslim lands, because nowadays the people in the Eastern world, especially in the countries around Islamic Republic, you can find it many, that the whole system is getting into the hands of the capitalist idea. And nothing remains out of the Islamic color, Islamic fragrance over there. You can see what's happening, you know, in the world of Islam nowadays. This kind of independence from the Western capitalist idea, I think, is good. But it needs its own ulema and scholars from within the lands of Islam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim. And Sheikh Qasim, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Americans are taking notice of high prices with growing alarm, and their concerns appear to be negatively affecting President Biden's approval rating, which had already been falling in recent months. We're prepared for you an article written by Joanne Grieve under the heading, US Democrats Worry Inflation Could Imperil Agenda and Congressional Majorities. As recently as this summer, Joe Biden seemed to be taking a keep calm and carry on approach when it came to concerns about rising inflation, the US president said in July. As our economy has come roaring back with some price increases, adding, our experts believe that the data shows that most of the price increases we've seen were expected and expected to be temporary. But now, with inflation hitting a 30-year high last month, President Biden's tone has become noticeably less upbeat. Biden said in Baltimore, Maryland recently, "Everything from a gallon of gas to a loaf of bread costs more." He added, we still face challenges and we have to tackle them. We have to tackle them head on. Americans are taking notice of high prices with growing alarm, and their concerns appear to be negatively affecting President Biden's approval rating, which had already been falling in recent months. As the US experiences stricter shocks at the gas pump and in grocery stores, Democrats are worried that inflation could imperil their legislative agenda and their majorities in Congress as crucial midterm elections loom next year. While the president and fellow Democrats have previously sought to downplay rising inflation, it has become an unavoidable issue as prices continue to climb. The Labor Department has reported that prices increased by 6.2% over the past 12 months, marking the most rapid uptick since 1990. Gasoline prices have increased by 49.6% over the past year, while food prices have risen by 5.3%. As prices rise, more working Americans are noticing their bills have become more burdensome, according to an opinion poll conducted by the progressive firm Navigator Research this month. 54% of the American public now say the cost of groceries and gas is a major crisis, marking a 17 percentage point increase since September. Republicans have blamed the price increases on President Biden's economic policies, arguing that rising inflation underscores the need to oust Democratic lawmakers in the midterm elections next year. Emma Vogan, a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee, said, "As Biden and Democrats continue to push for trillions more in reckless spending and higher taxes, skyrocketing prices and a broken supply chain under Biden are crushing American families, workers and small businesses. Americans will soundly reject Biden's failed economic agenda at the ballot box in 2022. There are some early signs that Republicans' message is striking a chord with voters as the party looks to take back control of Congress in 2022. An Associated Press VoteCast survey showed that 35% of voters in Virginia named the economy and jobs as the most important issue facing the state, making it the most common response. Those voters were more likely to support the Republican gubernatorial candidate Glenn Youngkin, who defeated Democrat Terry McAuliffe by 2 percentage points in the election held earlier this month. And it's not just Republicans who are sounding the alarm about price hikes. Senator Joe Manchin, one of the key holdouts in Democrats' negotiations over their $1.75 trillion spending package, has said he is hearing more from constituents who are concerned about their gas and grocery bills. Senator Manchin said in response to the Labor Department's latest report, "By all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse." He added, "From the grocery store to the gas pump, Americans know that inflation tax is real, and D.C. can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans are feeling every day." Senator Joe Manchin has previously expressed concern that Democrats' spending package, known as the Build Back Better Act, could negatively contribute to inflation. In a September opinion editorial for the Wall Street Journal, Senator Manchin warned against approving more government spending, saying an overheating economy has imposed a costly inflation tax on every middle and working class American. The Biden administration has sought to mitigate inflation-related concerns about the bill, which passed the House on Friday, 19th of November. The president has repeatedly touted a letter from 17 Nobel laureates in economics, which argued the spending package would ease long-term inflationary pressures. But the bill's critics say the legislation would not address the inflation happening now and may even cause prices to rise further, urging members of Congress not to approve another large spending package. Curtis Dubey, a senior economist at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a pro-business lobbying group that opposes the spending package, said, "We're not worried about the long term. We have inflation in the here and now, and this policy will make it worse in the foreseeable future." Curtis Dubey added, "The first rule of being in a hole is to stop digging. This would keep digging, so they need to not pass it." Jason Furman, who served as the chair of the White House Council on Economic Advisers under Barack Obama, rejected that argument. Jason Furman claimed, "Build Back Better will have a negligible impact on inflation over the medium term," adding, "In gross terms, the total spending is one-tenth as much per year as what we just did this year with the coronavirus relief package. Moreover, that spending is paid for." For progressives, conservatives' warnings about inflation seem a convenient excuse to quash a bill that they already opposed. Natalia Salgado, the director of the Federal Affairs for the Progressive Working Families Party, claimed the legislation could actually help average Americans deal with rising inflation by lowering their healthcare and childcare costs. For example, the Build Back Better Act would establish universal pre-kindergarten for all 3- and 4-year-old children. It would also reduce Affordable Care Act premiums and lower drug prices by allowing Medicare to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. Salgado said, "If we really want to have a discussion about inflation, let's talk about the many things that this bill is going to help minimize the cost of. Folks coming out of this pandemic were already hurting economically. It is economically imperative to pass the bill, to pass the Build Back Better legislation." Democrats in Congress have echoed that message, urging those who are worried about inflation to support the bill. Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, "House Democrats' Infrastructure Deal and Build Back Better Act tackle inflation head-on through their historic investments," adding, "Rather than working to solve economic problems, Republicans have voted overwhelmingly to block these bills, then reduce prices for the American people and focused instead on their own extremist agenda. But many of the provisions of the Build Back Better bill will not go into effect immediately. The Medicare drug price negotiations will not begin until 2025, and the universal pre-kindergarten program will be built up over the next few years. In the short term, it may be difficult for President Biden to address rising prices. Even if the U.S. Federal Reserve moves quickly to stifle inflation, it will take months for Americans to feel the effect of the fiscal policy change. And when it comes to gas prices specifically, Biden has little sway over the global oil market, although he has called on the Federal Trade Commission to investigate mounting evidence of anti-consumer behavior by oil and gas companies. Jason Furman said, "Politically, people are very sensitive to inflation in gasoline prices and food, because that's just a visible item they see. I've been in government when gas prices are going up, and it's terrible. Everyone hates you." Furman said, on the plus side for Democrats, the frequent fluctuations in gas and food prices mean those costs could decrease over the next year, even if overall inflation continues to rise. That possibility may be Democrats' best hope for maintaining control of Congress after the 2022 midterm elections. However, if prices do not improve over the coming year, the president's party may need to brace itself for an ugly election night next November.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.